BTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, offering an online master's degree in healthcare administration. Learn the skills necessary to be a leader and make an impact in the ever-evolving and diverse field of healthcare in partnership with UW Extension. Details at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's previously announced interview about the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra's upcoming concert needs to be delayed. We hope to bring you that interview either tomorrow or Friday. And we hope that you will take a moment to participate in the current fundraiser for Wisconsin Public Radio. Every gift that you make benefits WGTD. Go to WPR.org for more information. And thank you for your support. We're going on quite a journey for the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, a journey into the heart of Africa with one Kurt Davis, who went on an extraordinary journey, which in a sense he is still taking, leaving behind the rat race of Silicon Valley for a very different and far more meaningful pursuit. And he talks about it in a book called Finding Soul, From Silicon Valley to Africa, a travel memoir and personal journey through 20 countries in Africa. This is a book that is a combination of things. The publisher calls it a travel memoir, spiritual journey, and self-help book, all rolled into one. And indeed, this is a book that explores a lot of different topics and subjects and issues. And it is very, very interesting. And at the heart of it is Kurt Davis's search for deeper meaning in his life and trying to find ways to make a difference to some of the people of the extraordinary continent of Africa, and some of that work actually involving the nurturing of entrepreneurship, including doing so in some very, very unlikely places. And so we will explore all of that and more as we again talk about the book Finding Soul, From Silicon Valley to Africa, published by Morgan James. Kurt Davis, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Very excited to be here.
There's a line early in the book in which you say, "Before Africa, I didn't know much." So I think we're going to start with getting a sketch of what your life was like before you made this initial journey to Africa and began learning things that you did not know before. Tell our listeners whatever it is important for them to know about who you were and what you did before this life-changing experience.
Sure. I had spent, till that time, I guess I was about 38, 39, basically working in technology and working on building companies, doing business development sales at tech companies, also doing some finance. And so I spent a lot of time doing that, really just focused on what I would say my own personal wealth and my own personal status, if you will. I spent a lot of time in Asia as well, so probably maybe 8 to 9 years I lived in Asia where I was working on a variety of business endeavors. Now, the last one was a company that we helped build out of Silicon Valley for 7 or 8 years. And that process was just, it got to be, I burned out, basically. It was both mentally, intellectually, it wasn't very interesting. And quite honestly, the, you know, the games of Silicon Valley are exhausting, and what you go through. And so, you know, I got to a point where I just said, you know, enough is enough. And I decided there had to be something more, find something more meaningful. And decided as I started to kind of research and read more, and also kind of look into myself, like, who was I really? What was I wanting? What was I yearning for? I started to think, you know, possibly just doing things I hadn't done, like doing things for others, looking at parts of the world or places that are really vulnerable or haven't had the opportunities that we've had here in the U.S., and just trying something else. I love to teach. I always had liked to teach. I'd always done that as part-time jobs or whatnot. And so I decided, you know, if I could combine my love of teaching and exploration into something that would be a fun, you know, gap year, if you will. I know a lot of the younger millennials talk about taking a gap year, which I totally think you should do. I decided that, you know, I would explore a new part of the world I hadn't seen, which was Africa. And I would try to find ways to contribute there and give back, not to be a white savior, quote unquote, just to go there and learn and also get to know people and do different things in a more kind of altruistic sense. Mm.
You mentioned that you actually had spent some time in the Far East, and specifically Japan, and your first time there back in 1999 was teaching English to middle schoolers. I wonder if just briefly you can kind of compare what it was like to be an American in Japan in a couple of different ventures versus being an American in Africa and in a number of different nations in Africa. How different were those two experiences for you on the most sort of visceral level?
Wow, that's a great question. You have to make me think about that one. I think you know, teaching English in Japan in 1999 was certainly a fun experience. I was in Osaka, and certainly the kids there weren't used to seeing foreigners yet. So that was, particularly white people. So that was interesting for them. But you know, the second time I came back to Japan, I was in Tokyo, and it's very normal to see foreigners in Tokyo. And I think the Japanese are more and more being accustomed to having not just Americans, but all different types of people come to Japan and enjoy the culture and enjoy life there. So I think Japan is changing slowly, but it's changing a lot and way more accepting to foreigners than it was, say, 20 years ago. Now, Africa, certainly, Africa is definitely different. And I think Africa is kind of a place where China and Japan were maybe 20 or 30 years ago. What is the white man doing here outside of South Africa? What are you doing traveling around? I got that question. Like, why are you here? And it was like really strange for Africans to sit there and think, well, you're here because you want to learn about Africa? Like, why would you want to learn about it? And so there's a lot of similar type of things. And it wasn't so much that they were, you know, oh, you know, this is what a, you know, hey, this is what a white person looks like. It's more like, why are you here? And I think, that's the difference in the experiences. As more and more people get interested in Africa, whether it's, from any, you know, there's lots of Chinese, there's lots of big China influence in Africa, and Europeans now are getting more and more interested. So as more and more of this happens, it'll be interesting to see how the African countries receive foreigners. I'm very curious to see what will happen in the next 5 or 10 years with that, because as we know, in China, they technically just don't want foreigners there anymore, right? They just don't want us there. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. It was interesting. One of my favorite interesting scenarios is in Ethiopia. I was traveling around, and the kids would run around in Ethiopia and they would call me Chinese man, Chinese man. So that was really interesting in Ethiopia.
Wow.
They thought I was Chinese.
Interesting. You've already drawn a distinction between South Africa and the rest of the African continent for understandable reasons in terms of where one is a bit more likely to see a white person. But beyond that, of course, I think one general mistake that many of us in the West tend to make is by talking about Africa like it's one thing. And it is, of course, one continent. But within the continent of Africa are a multitude of different nations and all kinds of different traditions and all kinds of different realities. And I suspect that through the course of your time in Africa, that's one of the things that you have learned as well, that one should be careful about making generalizations, especially about as splendid a continent as Africa.
Absolutely. I mean, Africa is 56 different countries, right? And it's no different than, and it's very similar to the 50 different states we have in the U.S., people who have differences. And, you know, there's a lot of similarities in the different countries, going from food and culture, music, and the cool things, but there's a lot of differences as well, from outlooks, vantage points, religious values, mixing in foreign investment versus not foreign investment, like government control. Like they're all so very different. It's very obvious. I mean, there's nothing more different than Zambia and Zimbabwe, right? If you go to these two countries where Zambia is a place where the government's trying to get foreign investment, they're building up malls and they're trying to really, you know, use a lot of the resources that have come out of the northern part of Zambia and develop the country, as opposed to Zimbabwe, which is still ruled by an iron fist of Mugabe and his, you know, or the next generations of Mugabe. And he's not there anymore, but and so forth and so on. So just very different, right? Maybe much more different than the 50 states, but in some ways it's akin to that, I used to think.
We're speaking with Kurt Davis and talking about his book, Finding Soul, From Silicon Valley to Africa, a travel memoir and personal journey to 20 countries in Africa. You've already touched on the fact that you experienced what some people would call kind of burnout from what you were doing in Silicon Valley for all the success that you enjoyed there. At one point in the book, you write, "I didn't want to do what I did before, fall in line with the rest of the technology soldiers, work hard, run the rat race, and hope I'd catch a break." You were interested in doing something very, very different in journeying to Africa and perhaps doing some kind of work with would-be entrepreneurs, and we'll explore that in just a moment. I'm just curious, did you feel any fear that you were, in a sense, bringing something potentially kind of ugly to a beautiful land like Africa? I mean, in the sense that you know, you were an entrepreneur and experienced success, but also plenty of dissatisfaction and so on. And here you were going to Africa, in a sense, trying to train people to enter the same sort of arenas and maybe experience something like sort of the same thing. I'm just curious if those kind of thoughts entered your mind at all at the time, or even in retrospect as you think back on some of what you've done in Africa.
Also a great question. I think, you know, the beauty of in entrepreneurship in building companies, it's a really wonderful thing. It's something that we should empower people in the U.S. to do. It's probably the fastest thing to empower people in developing countries to get them out, to build up rising incomes and empower others to create jobs and whatnot. And as I traveled Africa, I started to rekindle the whole idea that, hey, you know, entrepreneurship is empowerment. It is building hope. It is letting people control their destinies. And there's a lot of power in what entrepreneurship brings. Innovation, disruption, new things. And so by all means, like, you know, this was an experience that I went through. And it was my own experience, which I still today like to build. I'm starting another company, but like working for people, going through the difficulties of building a company, and then also like the games played in Silicon Valley. Like, and I'm not going to like expand on those, but there's lots of games in order to keep certain people in power, make sure the 100 millionaires and billionaires stay billionaires. Like, there are games that are played, and possibly that's in another book that I'll write. But like that was more to me the difficulties and the things that I thought were like, huh, maybe the way this is structured in Silicon Valley isn't the best way that it could be structured for everyone. And also maybe I didn't make the right decisions, right? And that's also self-reflection. Perhaps I made the wrong decisions as well. So plenty of people do wonderful things in Silicon Valley, and they go off and start companies. And I know since I left, all the people that I knew have gone off and started new companies and done really well. So, like, there's lots of good things to it, right? But at that point in time when I wrote it, I was really disheveled, and I was really kind of fed up with the system and how it worked, and thought certainly there can be some changes in it.
Right. So it's almost,
I still do think there can be some changes.
Sure. So it's almost as though entrepreneurship itself is not the problem. It's, in a sense, kind of the kind of entrepreneurship that you were part of, or the environment in which you were being an entrepreneur that was maybe not the very best match. And perhaps you saw Africa as an opportunity to experience entrepreneurship maybe in a purer form. Would that be a good way
to
summarize
it? Absolutely. It's a lot more, there I just saw it, especially, in where I was in the U.S., I was also kind of an employee. It wasn't my company that I had worked for. I certainly, at that time, which was very different, again, decade later, very different than now, there were just some different obstacles, I think. And now when you're in, in India or China, the early days, the openness in which you can create, there's lots of nothingness into something, there seems to be a lot more opportunities. And but again, I think it's also like when you're in a place like Africa, there are people who look at the West and see all that we have, who want to build and create environments for themselves too. And they want to have what we have in many ways. And so you see that, and then you say, wow, I'd really like to help these people. Because even a bad day or like a situation that doesn't work out in the U.S. is not so bad, right? Like if you play the game remotely well, whereas in Africa, like, it's a lot worse. Yeah. your consequences are a lot worse.
So sure.
I think the passion and the hope, and you see that in their eyes, and they're like, yeah, let's do something together. Like, there's the whole idea of like, yeah, let's do something together. That kind of transcends race, and it transcends ideologies. It's like, let's go build something together is a powerful thing to tell others. So, and it's fun. Like, building things generally is pretty fun, right? It's a fun thing to do.
Of course. So. There's a line in the book that really kind of haunts me, and it's something that someone was telling you about the situation in at least many parts of Africa, when they said, talent is everywhere, but opportunity is nowhere. That's the problem we have. Can you tell us more about that situation and the way in which you were trying to do something about that?
Yeah, I think I was at a township when I heard that quote in South Africa, which, the townships were created as a function of apartheid to separate white and black people primarily. There were some other races involved as well. But what happened is that, you start to see that, if the mind is cultivated in a way that there are people where, there's lots of talent. There's lots of people who can do lots of things. That even that even applies to the U.S., right, where we have, you know, an increasing amount of disparity. And but the problem then becomes is that the opportunities don't. And when you say opportunities, there are, you know, jobs, of course, just straight jobs. But what I would say is even more powerful than straight jobs, especially in the world of entrepreneurship, is the access to capital. And how do you get access to capital if you want to build something and create the opportunities out there? And so that's the gap, right? And when you are in an environment, again, we can relate this to the U.S. as well, in certain communities in the U.S. where they don't, where people don't see opportunity, where people don't see a path to a better future, then things get ugly. And you can, if you're empathetic, you can start to understand why, right? Especially for people who are trying, people who want that, right? You know, that's the thing that we should also think about as Americans. Like, hey, you know, we have to be honest with ourselves that, you know, opportunity isn't everywhere for people, and our job as citizens should be to create opportunities for people. You know, I think that's one of the, when you start to see calls on the things that we've experienced recently, especially the Black Lives Matters and other situations where people don't see opportunity, they get upset, right? And there's more to it, obviously, but
so
that was the point. That was what I thought.
So tell us about some of the ways in which you learned something about the very nature of entrepreneurship as it played out in Africa, because I should think that that was one of the most valuable experiences for you, was to be an entrepreneur, but in environments drastically different from what you had experienced in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I would, you know, I think the biggest difference was that because capital and, you know, the end game, the end result probably isn't to make millions and billions and publicly listed offerings and things like that. Perhaps it is one day. I mean, there are companies that are happening, getting sold now. Company just got sold to Stripe. There's a publicly listed e-commerce company that's doing pretty well in Nigeria. But, you know, I think they look at entrepreneurship really in terms of two or three variables. One is, can I do something to help my community? Can I do something to help all the people around here that are struggling or that need to be helped? So that's like their first measure. And then I call it community entrepreneurship, like I saw in Zambia. The next is, you know, they do things that are more out of practicality and passion, right? Like there's some combination of practicality and passion. Like we need this. This is something that improves lives. This is not something that exploits the weakness of individuals, which I think a lot of Silicon Valley does. I think it plays to humans' detriment, like Facebook and Instagram does this. It really worse. It's caused a lot of mental health issues, like Snapchat, right? Takes the attention of our teenagers and our kids rather than, you know, why not, you know, take that tool and do something that helps America. Like, I think Silicon Valley plays way too hard, right? To the detriment of people. You know, now I think there's other innovations, clean tech and all this great stuff that's happening, which is good. So that's like the second thing that I think is different. Third, it's, you know, this is, entrepreneurship is empowerment for many people. It's sometimes their only thing, right? If they don't do something, they have no other option. It's not like they can go get a job at Google, right? Like, they can't go get a job. If you're an entrepreneur, like how many people I know started companies that failed and just went to Google, right? And got their $500,000 a year job or something. Like, you don't have that option. So sometimes it's your only option. And this is what you can make of the world, right? And so in some ways, it's really, really inspiring to see somebody say, I don't have an option, so I have got to create something, and I've got to do something. And so that, to me, was one of the most, interesting aspects that I learned from, and inspiring, too, because like now I sit here in my situation, and I say, I'm going to act as if I were one of them in the U.S., and I'm going to act and build and see what I can do, right? And then I use these themes in my life now, community. How do I make community better? How do I make things around me better? How do I use practicality, what people need, and add that into my mix? So these are kind of the basics of which I'm applying to my life now.
Right. I thought it was interesting that very early on after getting to Africa, you encountered some young people who were all about wanting to make money. And, I mean, for some understandable reasons, they told you, with money, we can get out of here. I mean, get out of unhappy situations or settings. How can I make lots of money? Money solves everything. And you say, I wanted to move their minds from the pursuit of money to something else. I thought that was really interesting because, in the careless generalizations that we in the West tend to make about people in other places, that, you know, that somehow caught me really by surprise, that these young people that you were meeting early on would be consumed with interest in making money the way, you know, a lot of young people here are consumed with that very same hunger. I wonder if that surprised you as well, and how hard was it for you to kind of move them away from that particular goal to something that I think you thought might be maybe more meaningful and maybe more practical as well?
Yeah, I think it was my own personal experience where I had been setting so much of my mind on how do I optimize for making more money, or how do I do it XYZ to make some more money. And then I started to realize, like, that equation doesn't work, right? Like, it doesn't work for my own happiness and well-being, because then you start to make decisions that optimize for that, but not for your own happiness, right? And so what I wanted them to do, and especially with them, is they may, you know, I hope that people at that those schools could get into colleges. They were all very smart. You know, I would say some of them, who I've met in that school were more worldly and, you know, knew American politics better than our kids do, been more interested in it. Hopefully they will go to college. And I said to them, find things that can make impact, find things that can give you purpose. Not just passion, but purpose, because I think passion, you know, you can be passionate for mountain biking, but that may not make it, you know, make a living. I said to them, look, money does matter. I'm not going to lie to you. Like, you want to be able to live. You want to be able to not, you know, do things that you want to be able to, you make some amount of money, but getting rich is not necessarily going to fulfill your purpose, right? And by following a purpose and I would point to some of the Mandelas and, you know, other people that say, look, you know, these people follow a purpose, and that gave them lots of impact and live the life to their fullest, right? So you need to figure out what that purpose is for you. But if you chase money, if that's the outcome, then you're going to go down maybe a path that's not going to optimize for what you want, right?
Do you have time for a couple more questions?
Sure.
Let me reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Kurt Davis, author of Finding Soul, From Silicon Valley to Africa, a travel memoir and personal journey through 20 countries in Africa. Kurt Davis made the decision in 2017 to take what he was thinking of as a gap year, removing himself from the rat race of Silicon Valley, and relocated to Africa, where he began working with young would-be entrepreneurs and in a variety of different settings. One thing I had meant to ask you that I've not managed to yet is to ask you about your own ADHD. You tell us in the book that you were at some point diagnosed with ADHD, and you write at one point that ADHD was for you a blessing when creating new ideas and a curse when not satisfied. I wonder if you could tell us more about your ADHD. First of all, as it played out in your previous life as an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley, and also how it played out for you more recently while doing this work in Africa. And I wonder if your ADHD has felt different or been a different sort of blessing and or curse for you. I'm just kind of curious what difference it has made in all of these interesting adventures and journeys that you have had.
Thank you for that question. I think it's a very timely question, as I know a lot of our youth and other people struggle with this these days, and it's not any easier with all of the information and technology that we have at our hands today, that are in front of us, that inundate us with more information and so forth and so on. That makes ADHD even worse. But I think, you know, previously I had, you know, we've been traveling a lot, but I had a little bit of a hard time sitting there and like executing things, right? Like as an engineer, or as someone would sit down and I'd be very restless. And I didn't really identify because I was able to push through things like through working extra harder, being a workaholic. But also then going through spells where I'd get like very, upset that I couldn't execute certain things or I couldn't do the ideas that I wanted to do. Or I would get distracted very quickly and want to go do, a different idea, or I'd want to go to a different context. It was a constant like push and pull. And I think I struggled with that, and started to realize it was a problem, more and more, especially when I was spending time in Japan. And then I started to talk to some doctors and they were like, hey, I think you really need to work on getting this treated and, identifying with it. And so I kind of went through some of my own stuff, a lot of meditation. I did a 10-day meditation retreat. I did some other things, which started to really calm my mind. Right. And that was that was the first step in treating it. I still meditate. I try to meditate daily. I don't always do it, but to calm the mind and to realize that to start to segment some of the ideas and the emotions and the mental aspects and to parse them out and to realize that, taking time and doing things in a step-by-step format is how to execute. And so I went through that process. And then when I went to Africa, I took things very slowly. Like while I was moving quickly from a movement, I didn't try to do much other than what I was doing in the moment, right? Like someone said to me, there's a quote in the book, you learn so much by just being there, by just being in a different place, by traveling, that you don't have to add more to it. You don't have to create, a big project while you're doing it. So I just kept things very simple, and sometimes that's the better way to do it. Just be simple, blog a little bit, read some books about the area you're in, and enjoy the journey, right? So that's what I tried to do. Since I've been back, I have, worked a little bit harder, trying different medications and different things, from habits, changing my habits, and which has been very helpful, and working on that so that I could, sit down and write a book about the journey and also start working on some of my other projects. Hmm. Yeah. So,
one thing I saw in your book that kind of leapt out at me that I wanted to ask you about is actually four letters, FOMO, which you tell us stands for fear of missing out. And I think in the context that where you at least first talk about that, that's a real kind of Silicon Valley thing. I mean, that's part of what drives people to work around the clock and give up all kinds of other pleasures of life for this sort of incessant fear that there is some opportunity out there that's going to sort of slip from your grasp if you're not working hard enough or not completely occupied all of the time. I think that's the context in which you're talking about this fear of missing out. Could you just talk about that for a moment and to what extent your journey to Africa and your experiences there were a way of trying to kind of come to grips with this?
This is a great question. You know, you go from an environment in Silicon Valley where there's tons of opportunities, where seriously, like, if you don't get a certain job, you might have missed $100 million, right? And I know friends where they could have done things and they would, you know, have been 100 million. And then, you know, or like I could have gone, you know, route B instead of route C, and route B definitely would have made me a whole lot more money. And so there's always this constant movement of things happening where you could have done X or something could have, or someone could have chosen you, but they didn't choose you. They chose somebody else. And so there's always this constant doubt of like, am I doing the right thing and whatnot. And so your mindset gets into that mindset, especially if you are a business developer, kind of networker where you know lots of people, you're following what's happening. Whereas, you know, by the way, the millennials talk about FOMO a lot when they talk about, well, I'm missing out of this party or I'm missing out of this experience, right? So this is where it all came from because I have younger nieces. And then you go to Africa and you're like, forget it all. Forget all of that stuff. Like, who cares, right? And you're just like, let's just go do something different. And you start to realize, like, like, maybe there is no missing out, right? Like, maybe where you are and what you choose to do is what you should, the moment, the present is what you should value. And maybe I'm not missing out. You know, you can create your own journey. And I think I started to slowly lose that. I mean, it takes a little time to get out of a certain mentality. So after 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, you start to say, you know what, I really don't care. You know what, I'm not going to check TechCrunch or I'm not going to check the latest tech news. I really don't care. Like, I'm not missing out of anything, right? And your brain gets wired in a certain way. And the news does that. And your environment does that. Your environment does that. And then when you take yourself out of it, it slowly starts to, hey, you know what, it's not for me, or I'm not missing out, right? By the way, just to end that, FOMO goes to JOMO, fear of missing out, to joy of missing out.
So, I like that. One of the things you talk about in the book at some length is racism. And, of course, you were a white man in Africa. And in many places, you were in environments where it was uncommon for a white person to be, or you were doing things that was uncommon for a white person to do. And along the way, you really learn something about racism as it plays out in some of these places. I know one of the most memorable stories you tell about that involved you wearing a certain jersey. Would you mind telling our listeners this interesting story and the lesson that you learned from it?
Sure. You know, I've lived in Asia for like 8 or 9 years, and I've gone even to an all, you know, predominantly black school in South Carolina in high school. So I've been a quote unquote minority in places, and I've experienced that. What was interesting in South Africa was there's a lot of obviously tension, and the tension is felt in the air, it's sad that it's still like that. There's a lot of history there. The experience was interesting because I felt like I went to a kind of a surf house and didn't think much of it, got there without trying to do some surfing. And it was a nice little spot. It was obviously in a predominantly white neighborhood or area. I was just kind of doing my own thing. And I had about a week before in South Africa, had picked up this Vodafone Kaiser Chiefs yellow jersey. It was a yellow orange. It was a really cool color. And so I was like, oh, and they were kind of like, you sure you want to wear this jersey? And I was like, you sure you don't want the rugby jersey? I was like, no, I like that color. I want that jersey. But I didn't know why the guy was saying it. And so then I went to the surf shop or the surf place, and I kept wearing the jersey. And these guys kind of snubbed me. And I was like, well, why'd y'all, like, the whole little place went out to dinner, and they just walked right by me, and they didn't even bother. And it was like it's supposed to be a guest thing. And I was like, well, maybe I'm just being too sensitive. Like, I don't know. And so the next morning I decided to leave, and the guy basically had a conversation with me, and he said, oh, you don't realize that, you know, this is this jersey you're wearing, you know, we don't like soccer. I said, who's we? He's like, well, white people don't like soccer. It's a black man's sport. Whereas rugby, and they're now changing the, you know, rugby is the white man's sport, even though there were some quota, I don't know all the specifics, but there were some quota things about how many, you know, having more black people on the rugby team and all these things. And I just said, look, dude, like, I'm just wearing an orange jersey that I like. I'm sorry that you had to pin racism against this. You know, he's like, yeah, and that was the story. Again, it was kind of weird how the dots connected there. But, you know, certainly the racism is still very strong in that area. But then it also makes you think as you're going, like, you know, where inside of me, how deep inside of me do I have racial tendencies, right? Do I have these natural instinctual thoughts that come out? And I think later in my trip, I talk about being in Uganda where I was getting off a bus in the middle of the night. And this is my favorite quote in the book, is saying, hey, get off the bus in the middle of the night. And, you know, I'm kind of scared, right? But there's no reason I should be scared. It's not like I should have any reason to be scared. And there are like people around, it's like 2 a.m. and there's big people like zooming around their motorbikes, and some of them are playing games. I don't know what they were doing. And I get off and I'm just like totally sweating and like sitting there, and this guy approaches me and I get a little bit scared, a little bit tepid. And the guy says, you want some water? You look really tired. And so the guy went off and got me a bottle of water. He said, I'll give you a ride to your hotel. And I realized inside, like, you know, maybe something instinctually inside of me is maybe a little bit racist or fearful for no reason. And I started to think about how that changes me as a person. And then somewhere it hit me, you know, he's just a soul like me trying to help another soul out, right? Like, that's all this guy was doing. And somehow I had pinned something on him before he even said something to me. And I said, oh, you know, we're all just souls. And I took that idea as I walked around the rest of Africa. And I really just went anywhere. I just said, hey, they're just souls like me. I'm just checking out what y'all are doing over here. Hmm. And people were like, hey, what's up? Come on in. I was like, okay. So it was cool.
Yeah.
Again, South Africa is a little different. South Africa has a lot of history and a lot of tension. When you go to some of these other places, you know, they don't really, they're more interested in why are you like wandering around and hanging out? Like, what are you up to?
Right. You do talk in the book about learning a great deal about empathy. And empathy is one of those things that, one of those words that we can be kind of careless about in how we use it. And certainly a lot of us probably are empathetic to a very sort of lazy degree. And I think in this trip to Africa and in some of the people you worked with, you learned what real empathy is. What would you tell us now about what it means to be truly empathetic for others?
I think the key is, you know, really, really going down, you know, two or three steps when you start to feel the emotion of another person, you know, that's like the initial layer. And then you start to put yourself and start to understand them and work with them and put them on your shoes. And then the third level is where really you're working side by side with them, really understanding, trying to understand their situation, what has been the background of where they've come from to get to where they are. And then you put yourself side by side and try to work with them or, you know, be friends with them. But there, you have to withhold judgment, and you kind of have to withhold all these other things that might be ingrained inside of you, but just to be and to allow them to talk and allow them to, you must hear them, and you must try to. You may never really truly understand them, but you have to hear them. You have to sit there, and then you have to kind of go from where you are at that point to the future of, you know, what's the way we get to a point where, you know, we can either work together or we can help each other or help you and, you know, whatnot. Because I think that's the starting point to really empowering people, and not assuming you know what they want or, you know, assuming you know where they came from and not judging it, right, as well. So I think it's something I learned. It's not always easy for me being, like, you know, sales ambitious guy trying to you know, show my passion in certain ways. You have to kind of peel all that back and try to just be with that person, like, and hear them. I don't know. I hope that answered the question.
Yes. To finish out in our last couple of minutes, our listeners would need to explore this a bit more on their own, but at least give them a brief understanding of some of the extraordinary work you've done in this Kakuma refugee camp.
Right. So went to Kakuma refugee camp and had a really lovely person named Innocent who supported me. Now, lots of interesting names in Africa, Innocent and Pride and Trust and things like that. I think they're great names, by the way. If you ever want to name your kid something, I think it's a cool name. But Innocent, it invited me in. He said, you know, you can't come unless you got something to offer. But he was negotiating from the first day. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to teach this entrepreneurship course. Like, we're going to go start some company. He's like, yeah, this is the best idea ever. So he invites me in and organizes 150 people to come to our entrepreneurship class. And we go off and start all these companies and try to get funding. Everybody's like, we don't have any money. I was like, well, okay, let's figure out all the ways we can pull money up through the community. We can raise a Kickstarter campaign, or, you know, which we have actually not done a Kickstarter campaign, but we should do that. And then we've gotten pulled some money from all the resources. Recently just raised $20,000 for it to build more Wi-Fi networks. So two of our projects are Wi-Fi networks and motorbike leasing. And so what we're trying to do is empower these entrepreneurs to go off and build their own things, because, quite frankly, you know, we don't know what they want, but they want to do stuff and they want to be productive and they want to work. I mean, you're sitting in a refugee camp, you don't have a lot to do. You want to work, right? People want to do things. And a lot of these people, because they are refugees, they're refugees because they're not refugees because they're poor and they they're refugees because they got kicked out of their countries mostly, right? And you get kicked out of your countries because you were a journalist, because you were saying bad things against your government, or you were a really smart engineer and they don't want people, you know, building things that could possibly break a regime things like that, right? Like any dissent that can be interpreted in some of these places, people got kicked out, right? So you end up in a refugee camp. So there's a lot of brains in these refugee camps. You know, you wouldn't think that, but there are. Innocent was a double electrical engineer. When I met him, he was building, he was mining Ethereum off of it, which, you know, one of the cryptocurrencies, on his smartphone. So they had like five, you know, it was really interesting what they were doing. They're really smart people. So we're now trying to empower these guys to build companies. Innocent has recently gotten into the Switzerland UNHCR, which is a refugee organization, to empower them to build companies and whatnot. So he just finished up there in Geneva, and now he's back trying to see if he can build up the company and get more investment. And so we hope to continue. We'd love to have anyone contribute if they'd like. Go to kakumaventures.com, K-A-K-U-M-A, ventures.com. And we have videos there and Innocence there, and you can see the team and all that great stuff.
Very good. In the meantime, the book is Finding Soul, From Silicon Valley to Africa, A Travel Memoir and Personal Journey Through 20 Countries in Africa, published by Morgan James Publishing, the author Kurt Davis. Kurt Davis, thank you so much. This was fun. Best wishes to you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on the morning show, you'll learn about a new project in Walworth County, which will allow mental health professionals to ride along with police officers on certain crisis calls. Also, a preview of the next Lake Geneva.